From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherie Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Jenna Rollins, a great actress and a pioneer of independent cinema. She starred in many films directed by her late husband, John Cassavetes, including A Woman Under the Influence, Faces, and Gloria. Now she's starring in a new film directed by her son, Nick Cassavetes. And we remember Tiny Tim, the eccentric singer who was immersed in the pop music of earlier eras. Tiny Tim died Saturday of heart failure. He was 64. We'll play our interview from last summer in which he performed, and we played music from his record with Brave Combo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has awarded astronaut Shannon Lucid the Congressional Space Medal of Honor. Mr. Clinton says Lucid rolled back the frontiers of space and science with her 6 months aboard the Russian space station Mir. That's a record stay in space for a woman. The president also says Lucid has inspired a new generation of American youngsters, particularly girls. Defense Secretary William Perry joined Ambassador Walter Mondale in Tokyo today. They signed a U.S.-Japan agreement intended to cut the number of U.S. bases on the island of Okinawa. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
Under the agreement, 11 U.S. facilities will be returned to Okinawan landowners, including a large 10,000-acre tract used for survival training. Live firing exercises at the heart of Okinawan concerns for the environment and quality of life will be ended. But the current force level of 28,000 U.S. troops will remain unchanged. The policy of the United States has been to keep 100,000 U.S. troops forward deployed in the Asia-Pacific. It may well be a source of continued tension on Okinawa, though one senior government official said most of the irritation expressed during the last year centered on the intrusion of live fire exercises and aircraft noise rather than the presence of U.S. troops themselves. However, plans for an offshore heliport are already raising local protests, even before a location has been decided. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
France today asked Zaire to lift the diplomatic immunity of its ambassador to Paris after he acknowledged that the car he was driving killed two schoolboys in an accident on the French Riviera. David Culhane reports from Paris.
The accident has caused anger in France about the immunity from prosecution granted to diplomats suspected of wrongdoing. The French foreign ministry at first simply asked that Zaire recall the ambassador, Ramazani Baya. Zaire agreed, but thousands of people marched over the weekend in the town of Menton where the accident occurred. They demanded that the ambassador face prosecution. The French foreign ministry then proposed that Zaire lift diplomatic immunity so the ambassador could defend himself in a trial. Police say tests showed he had not been drinking at the time of the accident, but that there is strong evidence he was speeding. The ambassador has not yet left France. Because of the public uproar, French Foreign Minister Hervé de Charette says he will consider possible reform of the policy of diplomatic immunity. For National Public Radio, this is David Culhane in Paris.
Mother Teresa's doctors are confident the frail nun will regain her strength, but she's still in critical condition. Mother Teresa suffered a heart attack 10 days ago and underwent an operation to clear clogged arteries on Friday. On Wall Street, the Dow has fallen more than 36 points to 64.85. This is NPR. Heavy rain has made travel poor for motorists on the East Coast. Heavy rain has caused congestion on many roads. Slick roads are blamed for dozens of accidents in Connecticut, including one in which a tour bus was left on its side on Interstate 95. Reported injuries are minor. In the West, more snow is reported in the Sierra Nevadas. A California Highway Patrol dispatcher says there are 6 inches of it currently. Interstate 80 was shut down in two places yesterday, and westbound traffic from Reno, Nevada was backed up through the evening. Emergency 911 telephone systems are back to normal in parts of Iowa today after a weekend outage. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports from Des Moines.
This was the fifth time this year that at least part of Des Moines' 911 system failed. The crash, which affected a dozen counties, was apparently caused by a blown fuse at U.S. West's main office in Des Moines. U.S. West spokeswoman Lynn Gipple says that's a complicated problem when you're dealing with a complex technical phone system. Each time a call comes in, she says, the caller's name and address have to be retrieved from a database in either Minneapolis or Denver within milliseconds.
It is a highly technical system, and when we say it was a blown fuse, everyone probably thinks of just their own, you know, little fuse box in their houses. Obviously, it's something much bigger and much more technical than that.
The system was down for about 3 hours. Officials still don't know how many calls were affected. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
Czech President Václav Havel underwent surgery today, and his doctors say they removed a malignant tumor from his lung. A spokesman says the cancerous tumor was taken out without complications, and Havel's prognosis is very good. Half of Havel's right lung was removed as well. Havel is 60. He was hospitalized last week. He's a chain smoker and was hospitalized in 1983 for pneumonia he got while jailed for anti-communist work. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jenna Rollins is a great actress who is revered in the world of independent cinema. She was a pioneer of independent cinema, along with her husband, John Cassavetes, the screenwriter, actor, and director, who died in 1989. Rollins starred in several of Cassavetes' films, including A Woman Under the Influence, A Child is Waiting, Faces, Minnie and Moskowitz, and Gloria. On December 6th, the Anthology Film Archive in New York will begin a 10-day retrospective of her films. And she has a new film, Unhook the Stars, co-written and directed by her son, Nick Cassavetes. Rollins plays a suburban widow and mother of two children. Her son is married, her teenage daughter is in a period of rebellion and has left home in anger. Feeling alone and useless, Rollins becomes the full-time babysitter for the boy next door, whose own mother, played by Marissa Tomei, can't afford daycare while she works. In this scene, Tomei has taken Rollins out for a drink and a game of pool at the neighborhood bar.
What's the deal with your daughter? Why does she hate you so much?
Oh, I don't think she hates me, really. We're just so different.
She's right at that age I can't stand. She hates being told what to do. And she does everything wrong. I don't blame her, really. I've always preferred my son. Anybody could tell that.
What are you telling me? You like your son the best? Doesn't that violate a mother code? Aren't you supposed to like all your kids the same?
Yeah. But you never do.
Jenna Rollins, welcome to Fresh Air. I want you to describe the mother that you play in Unhook the Stars.
Well, she is a Midwesterner, a woman who has been very happy in her marriage and the raising of her children. She's a woman who hasn't had any other kind of work. And then she suddenly finds herself in the position of her husband is dead and her children are grown and out on their own. And she hits that wall of thick air that she just doesn't know whether she's coming or going, even though she's not a woman that panics easily. I think it's a feeling that men get when they retire from work. That's where she finds herself at the opening of the picture.
What did you feel you had in common with her, and what did you perhaps not relate to after raising three children yourself? But of course, you've also had a celebrated career.
I can't say that, of course, that my life is like Mildred's, because, as you say, I've always worked, I've always been an actress, and it's a very different kind of life. But I have had children, I have loved a man, I have lost a husband, and my children have, you know, moved out and grown up and gone off on me. And then I would think the most autobiographical part would be the relationship of Mildred, the character that I play, with the little boy across the street that I who's Marissa Tomei's son, who I start taking care of for her while she's working and separated from her husband.
What was autobiographical about that?
The relationship between Mildred and the little boy was much as mine was with my son when he was little.
Well, one of the wonderful things about the mother Mildred in Unhook the Stars, she's the kind of mother who knows how to provide structure and protection for a child. How to, you know, read to him and just make every little thing in the world seem like there's an interesting story behind it. Finding just like a safe, structured place for a child. Were you that kind of mother who really knows how to do that? Not every mother does.
Well, I don't know. I do have to admit that I read that encyclopedia to him.
Like the mother in the movie does.
Yes, which is some embarrassment to me now. Because I got on the set and I said, Nick, this child is pretty, you know, little to be reading an encyclopedia to. And he said, are you kidding me? He said, you read me that encyclopedia all through my childhood. And, you know, I had honestly forgotten. But I plead mother madness because, you know, when you're a young mother and you have a child, you want to teach him every single thing in the world. And I guess it makes a certain sense to start from A and go to Z in the encyclopedia, but it's a pretty heavy trip, too.
Jenna Rollins is my guest, and she's starring in the new movie Unhook the Stars. Now, I'm thinking about another role that you played in which there was... you played a mother figure, not exactly a mother. I'm thinking of Gloria, your 1980 mm-hmm. movie, which Sharon Stone is remaking. I love...
That's what I hear.
Yeah, I love this movie, Gloria. You play a woman who used to be connected to the mob.
Uh-huh.
And you're asked by neighbors who know that they're about to be executed by the mob to take care of their 6-year-old son. Now, the mob is going to be after the son, too, because the parents have given the son the books that they kept on the mob business. Now, your character, Gloria, doesn't think she has any maternal feelings, and she wants to ditch the kid. But when she's standing on the street and the mob guys come to get the kid, she blows them away, and then she and the kid really start to bond. How did you play the mother figure differently in both of these roles? You know, in one, you're this, like, really tough, gun-toting woman, and in the other, you're, you know, a Middle Western woman who has been a homemaker all of her life.
I think that the maternal instinct was as great a surprise to Gloria as anything ever could have been. I think it was instinctive. It just that desire to protect a child that a woman has, and probably men have too. And also, she realized they were going to kill him. She wasn't shocked or surprised by it. She knew them. She'd been there in association with them, and she just couldn't let it happen.
Gloria was, in a way, really out of character film for you. It's an action film in a way, and you're pretty handy with a gun in the film. Not your typical role. Did you enjoy that change of pace?
I loved it. It was such a fantasy. I mean, it's essentially here I am, and I'm going to take on the whole mafia and beat them. You know, which is sort of an incredible power trip.
While being very motherly at the same time.
While being very motherly at the time. But it was. I remember it was so strange carrying that gun at first. And then after a while, because I always carried it in my purse, so I could shoot through the purse if I needed to. Gloria, I'm speaking of, not me. And then afterwards, I was carrying the purse, because, you know, the prop man comes and takes it from you so there won't be an accident or anything at every occasion. And then all of a sudden, my purse would seem very light. And I thought, my, you get used to things very quickly and depend on things very quickly. It was, the whole thing was, and it was a tough picture physically because I was running around those 4-inch heels, sandals, and carrying the child over my shoulder and running through Harlem in, you know, 98 degrees heat and 1,000 humidity or something. So that it was a picture you got into shape very quickly.
A Woman Under the Influence, directed by your late husband, John Cassavetes. You played a woman married to a character played by Peter Falk. And you're having a nervous breakdown, and you just, like, unravel more and more as the movie goes on. Had you seen somebody going through that before taking on the role? Somebody who you could think about while doing the movie?
Not one person. You know, I wasn't thinking of one person, but I have seen people who so loved another person that it became an obligation to the other person. It wasn't a wonderful thing, and the person who loved too much developed nothing else in her life, so that when that love was withdrawn from her, that she had nothing to fall back on. I have seen that several times.
And how did you use that in the movie?
Well, just, you think, you study your part. I mean, just the way you would think that you do. A part is like reading a detective story. You are presented with... You don't write it. You don't start it in the middle. You interpret it. And very often you find things that they're doing, the character that you're doing, that puzzles you. And you wonder how and why. And so you take as much of... Because I believe that all of us have every quality. All of us. It's a matter of degree. And acting is a matter... of increasing the degree or decreasing. But it's always there, and you can always find it inside of you. It's just a matter, very often, of just sitting for quite a long time and thinking about things. And if, when you come to something that is extremely puzzling, to figure it out and think about things that you've seen and heard and people you've known. And all you need is just a little. It can be like a little piece of rice, but once you have the feeling, then you can enlarge it and take it where you wish to.
Were you enlarging on your own insecurities when playing the role in A Woman Under the Influence? And if so, if you have to draw on your own feelings to do that, did you feel in a very vulnerable state while making the movie?
It's strange that I did feel in a very vulnerable state, but I wouldn't say that that part is very like me, which is puzzling in a way because it affected me very deeply. I walked a little closer to the line than perhaps I should have in that, because it remained with me for a long time after the movie was over. I could hardly see a woman, you know, waiting for her children at a school bus without my eyes filling up with tears, or a woman walking along talking to herself, which you see so often, so very often. And then I would think of Mabel, and I'd miss her. You know, when you play a lot of characters, even though you're finished with them at the end of the movie, they don't ever really go away. They're always in your head and in your emotions, and you wonder what happened to them, what they're doing now, and you know how things worked out. It's sort of like a, I guess, a novel that you never quite get out of.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jenna Rollins, and she's starring in the new movie Unhook the Stars, which is directed by her son, Nick Cassavetes. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jenna Rollins. She's starring in the new movie Unhook the Stars. You were honored in 1994 by the Sundance Film Festival for your work in and support of independent film. You and your late husband, John Cassavetes, were making independent films before I think there was even a name for it. I mean, you were really pioneers of that in the movie industry. Why did you start? Why did you start finding your own little niche away from the larger industry?
Well, Of course, as you say, you don't think of yourself as a pioneer or even, you don't think of yourself in any particular way. It's just that you want to express a different kind of story, a different kind of, we felt that there's so much more that could be said on film and that films could be much more personal to the audience, that you could do pictures that were actually something that people would relate to because it was in their own lives. Because all of them really essentially are about love and the loss of love, or how to survive love, or how to find love, or how to keep love, or you know, what you do with it, which is really the eternal problem for all of us. And we thought it could be shown in a more natural setting, a more accessible way, rather than just say an action film or
a glamorous escape
film. But it's not that we wanted them to stop doing that kind of film. We just felt that there was a lot of room for a lot of kinds of film.
Now, camera equipment, film equipment, wasn't as affordable or accessible then as it is now. How did you go about starting off? It's one thing to have the ambition, but it's another thing to actually follow through, to get the money, to get the equipment, to find places to shoot, to find other actors willing to do it. Tell me how you put those pieces together.
Well, you're very right. Those are the practical problems. And you depend on the goodwill of people a lot. If there's not a lot of money involved, people are usually pretty wonderful about helping out. And we didn't, you know, have doodles for money. And so people would lend a camera. Kodak people would give us short ends of film. The person in the restaurant would say, okay, come on in, shoot in here. But, you know, but you can only be here from 4 to 6 or something. Or, I mean, everyone would make allowances for you. Everyone would do whatever they could. You can't make a movie by yourself. It really is a group effort. And people are awfully nice about pitching in when they know you're up against it.
Could you describe a little bit about what the guidelines for improvisation were within the films that you made with John Cassavetes? How much improvisation was there? What were the parameters for that?
The first film that he made, Shadows, was entirely improvised. I wasn't in that. And so then he did develop a reputation from that as doing everything improvisationally. But actually, after that, he always had a script. And, you know, not just a thrown-together script, a real script. But then when we would have, if you'd have a problem with a scene, or John's theory was that if he got a bunch of good actors together and there was a problem, that it was the writer's problem. So then we would stop and we'd talk about it, rehearse, improvise, work about it as much as we needed to. And then when we thought we had it, he'd go in and sit down and write the scene from the improvisation, the way he wanted it. And that's how we did most of them. Not all of them. There were lots of improvisations all the way through to the last films that we made. But mainly they were very scripted.
And so even the parts that were improvised, by the time you did the final take, it had been scripted based on the improvisation.
Mostly. I was thinking of one that is just the opposite of that. In our last picture, Love Streams, I played a woman who loved too much, loved her husband too much, loved her children too much. I did everything too much. I carried too much luggage. And I believed that love was a stream that could never, ever stop. And this I believed in spite of the fact that my husband just couldn't stand me. And my child was just right along his side because she just drove everybody crazy with her excessiveness. It says in the script that she calls the husband home from a business meeting and the child home from school because she knows that they are not getting enough fun out of life and that they are wasting their time with this sort of thing. So they come home thinking something important is happening. And then there's just this one little sentence, really. And it said, they come home and sit down, she makes them laugh. And I said, what does that mean, John? And how does she make them laugh? He said, don't worry about it. He said, I've got something great planned. You're going to love it. And I said, well, but do you have any hints or anything? He said, no. He said, I don't want to ruin it for you. He said, just wait. And I said, this is making me hysterical. And he said, no, I'm telling you. He said, I don't want to even give it away. So we got to the day that we were going to shoot, and he says, stay in the dressing room. I don't want you to see the preparations. And I really was truly hysterical. And finally he came and said, okay. He said, now, come on out. And we were shooting in the backyard of this beautiful home. And there was Seymour Cassell and Risa Bluett, who were playing my husband and child, and they're both sitting there. And they had a long picnic table. And on top of the picnic table, there were about 100 of those, you know, those crazy little games that you see, you know, those clattering, chattering false teeth and eyes that pop out on springs and catch bottles that look like they're getting stuff all over you. All that terrible, those joke store games. And John said, there, what do you think? I said, what do you mean, what do I think? Well, what am I supposed to do here? He said, make them laugh. I said, with these, I said, which ones? He said, all of them. He said, we've got a minute to shoot it. He said, and use every one, make them laugh, and then go jump off the diving board into the pool. So I said, well, shall we rehearse? He said, no. He said, I don't want to ruin the spontaneity of it. He said, okay, roll them. And so I just wildly started, you know, with the eyes and the ketchup and the thing. And of course, he had already told them not to laugh because in their characters, they were not amused that they'd been brought home, you know. And so now I got wilder and wilder, trying, you know, just anything to that. Finally, the minute had gone by and I went and jumped off the diving board. Then, of course, I realized why I was jumping off the diving board, because he had it planned that they weren't going to laugh. Now, that kind of improvisation was quite rare, because there was no rehearsal, there was no talking, there was nothing. It was just, you just went for it. And it, you know, he was right. It was more fun to do that scene. It's when I look back on it with a lot of happiness.
Jenna Rowlands stars in the new film, Unhook the Stars, directed by her son, Nick Cassavetes. We'll talk more in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That sly cigarette. Song sung in 1898 by Miss S.H. Dudley for the Runaway Girl. And Tiny Tim trying to redo it. If girls and boys were asked what joys they found the most entrancing.
Singer Tiny Tim died yesterday at the age of 64. Coming up, we remember him with a recent interview. And our conversation with Jenna Rowlands continues.
Although you think I'm joking, with twinkling eye they'd make reply, the best of all is smoking. Oh, sly cigarette, oh, fine cigarette.
sly cigarette. All fine cigarette. Why did you teach me to love you so when I have to pretend that I don't, you know, oh sly cigarette.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with actress Jenna Rollins. Several of her best-known films were directed by her late husband, John Cassavetes, including Gloria, A Woman Under the Influence, and Faces. Her new film, Unhook the Stars, was directed and co-written by their son, Nick Cassavetes. Your father, I believe, was a state senator when you were growing up. Do I have that
yes.
right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
In Wisconsin. In Wisconsin. And this was U.S. Senate? Oh, state senate,
no,
right,
no,
in the state senate.
No, state senate, Progressive okay. Party, which doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It was a La Follette Party, and it was very much, Wisconsin is an agricultural state, and it was very concerned with the citizens getting roads and getting access for the farmers to get their produce to the trains and the trucks and that kind of practical sort of the kind of it must be kind of nice really. I think how hard it is to be president, but working within a state, you can really get quite a lot done for your state, and I think he enjoyed it.
Did you ever have to be the model daughter while your father was in politics, or is that also too far in the past to remember?
Well, I was not a hard child because I was a sick child. I was an invalid when I was little, and so, you know, I wasn't much of a handful. I was lying around looking pale and reading books and things, so that I don't think that it was the same as if they had to trot me out, you know, with my little velveteen collar on or anything. I wasn't very involved in it.
What were you sick with?
I don't know, some weird kidney disease. And then that went into double pneumonia, and then that went into something. I think what I really think is my immune system probably was just not very developed. And because when I got to be a teenager, I'd never been sick again. And so I don't know. It was just one thing after another. They were all very kind of serious things, asthma and all of those things. But then they just all kind of magically went away, so I think something just kicked in.
Were you very unhappy during the period that you were sick?
No, I wasn't. I would like to have gone to school more in that sense, but I always was very happy reading, and everybody, you know, when you have a sickly kid, everybody's awfully nice to you. And they probably would have been anyway. But my mother would, in order to make me eat anything, she would go to all kind of extremes. I remember one time, I wouldn't eat carrots. I wouldn't eat anything yellow. So she cut a carrot into the shape of a goldfish. And with a long tail. And she put it in a goldfish bowl with water in it. And she came into where I was sick, and she said, "I have an uncontrollable urge." She said, "I can't stand it. I've got to eat this goldfish. I've got to do it. I'm going to." I said, "No, no, 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 no! Don't do it." She said, "I've got to. Unless you'll eat this carrot." And so I said, "Oh, all right." You know? But they would go to the most extraordinary kind of creative lengths to do these things for me. I really had a pretty happy childhood.
Well, that sounds wonderful.
It was.
Now, did you write for comic books before acting?
Yes. When I went to New York, and I worked, and then I was out of a job, and so I got a job. Mr. Gleason, Lev Gleason, gave me a job writing Crime Does Not Pay comic books. I wrote it for a long time, too, about a year or so.
These were like Action Comics with a moral message?
Yes, yes, I always, you know, but I mean, I really was up on, you know, a three-time loser at Donna Moore and all kind of justice things, but I always, of course, gave them an uplifting ending, a sudden conversion.
How long did you do that?
About a year, year and a half, till I got another job.
And when did you get seriously interested in acting?
When I was about 14, I was living in Virginia, and I won a scholarship to a local repertory theater in Washington, D.C. Arlington, you know, just outside of D.C. And so it was a wonderful, wonderful repertory, too. I mean, they tried the hardest stuff. Talk about fools rushing in where angels fear to tread. We were doing Joan of Arc and Leglon and Richard III, and I was Richard too. So I mean, they had an open mind, and a marvelous teacher. And I was the young one. Most of the guys were in their 20s, and it was a serious. We all took it very seriously and worked very hard for several years there.
Do you still use things that you learned early on as an actress, or have you developed your own style separate from that along the way?
Well, I think everyone does, you know, naturally develop your own way of doing things, but certainly those were very influential to the way I thought and studied and just, you know, generally it's the creative climate around you that you may not do things just the way someone else does, but just being there with other artists and everybody trying very hard to find the truth in the character, it's exciting.
Do you feel that your acting approach or the kinds of films that you're doing now have changed since the death of your husband in 1989?
Well, sure. In the first place, John wrote very great parts for me, and I'm a very lucky actress to have had so many, because an actress can go a whole lifetime. If you get one or two wonderful, really wonderful parts, you can consider yourself a lucky actress. And I had many more than that. And believe me, I'm grateful for it. And then now I look in parts for something. You know, when you first start out, everything is interesting to you because you haven't done anything. All the parts seem interesting to you. And then you've done that, and you've looked into that. And so you keep looking for new things that to explore and to think about. And I like to do modern parts rather than classic parts. I think we live in such a... you know, a fascinating time, and with all of the rules changing and everyone trying to change with them and figure out what's right and what's wrong, it's a period that I want to be involved in. And so I look for parts that I haven't done and that will reveal something to me that I haven't worked on. Or I'll work on something because I especially like I did something to talk about, because I wanted to work with Bobby Duvall. I love him, and he's a wonderful actor, and I've never worked with him, and we had, you know, a couple of really funny, nice, light comedy scenes, and I don't very often play light comedy. So there are all kind of reasons that I look for a part now.
Jenna Rollins, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Jenna Rollins stars in the new film Unhook the Stars. Later this week, the anthology Film Archives in New York begins a retrospective of her films. Coming up, we remember Tiny Tim. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. We're going to remember Tiny Tim, who died of heart failure over the weekend at the age of 64. I confess that I wasn't much interested in Tiny Tim until last summer. I had dismissed him as an eccentric one-hit wonder. His two claims to fame were the 1968 hit Tiptoe Through the Tulips and marrying Miss Vicky on The Tonight Show in 1969 in front of a record-breaking TV audience. But last summer I heard his record with Brave Combo, a band that first became known for its hilarious polka versions of rock hits. The record presented him with a winning amount of irony and sincerity. We had him on the show, and I was taken by his lifetime dedication to the pop music of earlier eras. Before we replay that interview for you, here's the title track of his CD with Brave Combo, his dark, almost sinister version of the Lennon-McCartney song, Girl.
Is there anybody there? Anybody there? Is there anybody gonna listen to my story? All about a girl who came to stay. She's the kind of girl you want so much it makes you sorry. Still, you don't regret a single day.
Oh, girl, girl, girl. Oh, girl, girl.
When I think of all the times I tried so hard to leave her, she will turn to me and start to cry. She promises the earth to me, and I will leave her after all this time. I don't know why.
Girl, girl, girl. Oh, girl, girl, girl.
She's the kind of girl that puts you down. When friends are there, you feel a fool. You say she's looking good. She acts as if she's understood. It's cool.
Girl, girl, girl.
I spoke with Tiny Tim in June. Tiny Tim, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good afternoon. It's Terry Gross. It's tight. Glad to speak to you and your wonderful show.
Do you call everybody Miss, by the way?
Yes, I call my wife Miss Sue.
How come?
Well, I do that. It's more formal. I don't want to take no one's name for granted. If I never even meet the person, I don't want to call them by their first name. It's not etiquette, and it keeps me in a very adequate sort of proper way.
So tell me, do you sing in a falsetto anymore?
Yes, right now, it's in the afternoon. This needs a lot of warm up. I'll just see if I can even do a poor version of. Oh, tiptoe through the tulips with me.
And how did you discover your falsetto voice?
Well, I thank Jesus Christ for every gift because I really prayed about it one day. And about 1952, I needed something to differentiate myself from better singers at the time, especially from Tony Bennett, Perry Como, Guy Mitchell. And so every entertainer, every artist, every comedian, every broadcaster should have a sound, an originality in the voice that the mass can identify with singly. And so originality is the key to success. You can close your eyes and know it's Louis Armstrong, know it's Bing Crosby, and the same thing, you know, it's Tiny Tim if I do tiptoe, whatever. And so that's what I looked for, that's what I got, and from 54 on, it proved to be successful.
Now, back in the 50s, before you were famous, how did you dress when you performed?
Another good question. Well, I had a usual shirt and tie and suit jacket. I didn't start wearing costumes until, 68, 69, and Mr. Sharp in Australia made me unbelievable costumes after that. But when you went to amateur nights, you always had a suit and tie on.
Short hair?
Yeah, until 54. Then everything changed. Not only did the hair become long, which I took a little bit from Rudolph Valentino. Mr. Valentino, in his book that he wrote in 1923, and he had his hair parted one way over the eyebrow. I wanted mine the other way. And the only difference is that while long hair was here since day one, the difference here is that I had white-faced makeup with it throughout the day. not just for show business. And the white face, whatever Jolson did to blackface, it happened here with whiteface and the long hair. So that in 1954 and 55 and 56, in the years that President Eisenhower was here and the McCarthy hearings were ending, I mean, that was a rough thing to look at 24 hours a day.
You said you were wearing the white makeup not just for show business. What were the other reasons?
Another good question, Ms. Gross. First of all, since I was not good-looking and I didn't want to cut this nose off, I was afraid of operations, I've always wanted to appeal to certain type of women I liked. Everyone has their dreams of what they want. And, of course, the hair was too short. So when I wore the makeup, I should also state that I still cleanse today about 8 to 12 times a day and use night creams and eye creams and throat creams and, of course, light makeup. But at that time, I wanted to also appeal to the women, even if they said, oh, I can't stand them. Look at that ugly thing in the subway trains. At least they were paying attention. So part of it was for show business, and part of it was to live within myself and be content. And it started to work on both fronts.
Excuse this cheap bit of psychoanalysis.
Go right ahead.
But it seems to me, in a way, what you're saying is that you felt unattractive, you felt like a freak, and so to transcend that, you kind of turned yourself into a freak by putting on makeup and growing your hair long.
Well, I was unattractive. I didn't think I was. I was a very ugly person when it came to looks.
Mm-hmm.
They looked at it as a freak, you know, with the white makeup, and mm-hmm. the world mm-hmm. looked at it that way. The world looked at the hair like that, and especially in the 50s, the middle 50s. But inside one's heart, I felt that I was especially wearing white makeup, not dark makeup, because white seemed, I've always looked at the princesses that I adored in my dreams to be equal with the white light, beautiful springtime. And I wanted to feel within me, with the songs and everything, that I had a sensuality with the women I liked. I don't know if I can explain it that way. And by wearing this light makeup, I felt even with myself by keeping clean. I've always looked at women as clean objects who wash their hands all the time with soap, who take care of their bodies and never offend.
So the white makeup gave you a sense of purity and cleanliness.
Beautifully put. Beautifully analyzed, yes.
Your big breakthrough in terms of celebrity was your recording of Tiptoe Through the Tulips.
Yes.
In fact, why don't we hear a little bit of it?
Tiptoe through the window, by the window, that is where I'll be. Come tiptoe through the tulips with me.
We're remembering Tiny Tim, who died Saturday night. More of our interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with more of our interview with Tiny Tim, recorded last June. He died of heart failure over the weekend. You know, I think in the business you're seen as a novelty act. Is that how
right.
you would like to be seen?
maybe not, but if it's so, fine, because I wanted to make it, and I prayed, of course, the right way, and if that's the cross I have to bear, fine. I like the songs, whatever's top 10. I have a heavy metal record in Sydney, Australia, with Highway to Hell, which I did in 1993, which never even came out to this country yet. I've done the song because I like the song. Youth makes all music. Youth made Ragtime in 1910 when they were saying, bring back the old songs then, like I Love You Truly. And youth made jazz in the 20s, right after World War I, and the boogie-woogie in the 40s, you know, and the rock and roll in the 50s after the blacks originally did it. So when I see these old-timers say, oh, what disgusting music it is, they haven't heard it. The rap and the beats and the soul are the music of this generation, and one has to be born again into these songs. That when I did Highway to Hell, just a snip of a... I'm on the highway to hell, living easy, living free, season ticket on a one-way ride. No, and that's with a heavy metal band. So definitely one must take and be born again into this new music today. Just, if I may do one more for you.
Oh, please.
Miss Terry? Yeah, this is now we just left Decoration Day. And there was another great song, ironically sung by Henry Burr, for the great veterans who died on Decoration Day, to remember them. In 1917, this great song. At a grand old meeting on Decoration Day, I heard a veteran proudly say, what makes us love this country, land of the brave and free? I'll tell you what, said he, it's liberty. L stands for love of our country, I for independence too, B for the brave men who fought for us, E the emblem dear at white and blue, R for the right that we fight for, T, true Americans will be. Y is for you and for your country too. That stands for liberty.
You certainly put your heart and soul into songs when you sing them.
Oh, listen, there are great romantic songs going back, you know, especially from 1848 and Stephen Foster's time to about 45. The great melodies in the gramophone years, so many like that, which I have listened to and which have consoled me in this business. It wasn't the loss of fame or never seeing the cash that got me. It was the broken hearts that I've suffered many years over romances due to my excitabilities or my simplicities that were broken up, and I couldn't get them back together again. You're so patient, Miss Terry. Just let me do one more number from that period that I sing many times when I think about some women I've hurt with too much of a hasty argument and I've never seen them again. This was written in 1916 by the late, great Ernest R. Ball and J. Karen Brennan, who wrote When Irish Eyes Are Smiling and Mother McCree. Also sung by Harry McDonough, great star. Just a snip, and thanks for your patience. Turn back the universe and bring me yesterday. Turn back the hands of time that hold life's golden ray. Take back that bitter hour when our love passed away. Turn back the universe and give me yesterday. Many a time I was singing, take back that bitter hour when our love passed away. I have experienced that many times in romances, and I've experienced that in 1985. I was working with the circus then, third-rate circus, Alan C. Hill Circus, going from town to town. And I came to a place in New Jersey where I worked, and or Pennsylvania, and they allowed me a night off to right after the circus to go to a new disco opening up in New York called the Palladium. There was a beautiful girl, Miss Lauren, there. She was I was so much in love with her. She was only 19 years old, and she liked me very much. I'll never forget that great night. But a few years later, about 88 or 89, I had some argument with her, and even though she's had arguments with other people. It was a shock coming out of this mouth, and nothing was the same after that. That's one incident. I wish I could take back that bitter hour when our love passed away. And to all your listeners, it is true. One word, one gesture can break up a romance.
You know, everybody's getting rid of their turntables and putting in CD players instead. I bet you still have a lot of 78s, right?
Not anymore, but I tell you, since you brought this up, I am the only, if I may say, celebrity entertainer who has at least one or two cylinders in the Edison Museum in Bellard, Illinois, since 1977, if it's still there. At that time, I recorded with my late conductor on the piano, Marvin Lewis, two Edison cylinder from the machine. They were nice out there to cut, you know, the old, they shave off the old cylinders for 2 minutes to sing some of the great, one or two great songs of 1904. And this is how I sounded through the cylinder horn.
Nothing to do, Nelly darling, nothing to do, you say. Let's take a trip down memory ship, back to the bygone days, back to the old village schoolhouse, back to the dear days of yore. Let's take a trip down memory ship, let us go there once more. School days, dear old golden rule days, reading and writing and arithmetic, taught to the tune of a hickory stick. You are my queen in calico, I was your bashful barefoot beau, and you wrote on my slate, I love you, Joe, when we were a couple of kids.
Tiny Tim, thank you so much for being with us.
Ms. Terry Gross, thanks for being a good listener, and it's a pleasure talking to you and your fresh air fun.
Tiny Tim, recorded in June. He died of heart failure Saturday. His latest CD features Christmas songs. It's on Rounder Records, as is his CD Girl with the band Brave Combo. We'll close with their version of Stairway to Heaven. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
There's a lady who's sure all that glitters is gold, and she's buying a stairway to heaven. And when she gets there, she knows if the stars are closed, with a word she can get what she came for.
Whoa, 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 and she's buying a stairway to heaven.
There's a sign on the wall, but she wants to be sure. And you know sometimes words have two meanings. In a tree by the brook, there's a songbird who sings. Sometimes all of our thoughts are misgiven.
Whoa, 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 and she's buying a stairway to heaven.
There's a feeling I get when I look to the west, and my spirit is crying for leaving. In my thoughts I have seen rings of smoke through the trees, and the voices of those who stand looking.
Whoa, 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 and she's buying a stairway to heaven.
And it's whispered that soon, if we all call the tune, then the piper will lead us to...
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.